This audio recording is copyrighted 2010 by AboutFacts.net and its licensors. All rights are reserved.
Why do you think we're using so many Japanese electronic parts in our weapon systems?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting point. It may be that they simply were the lowest bidder in the process for creating this system. It may be that they can create them more effectively and more cheaply than we can do over here in the United States. I don't know whether they have unionized labor in Japan or not. I really don't know, but I know that unionized labor in this country has increased the cost of individual products significantly over the last 100 years or so. And so it may have been that in order to satisfy whatever the component requirements were of these systems, that they really had to go to the most reliable and the least expensive producer of those components. And I would say that would have to be either, you know, South Korea or Japan. I know there are a lot of products being made in China right now, but many of them are knockoffs of things that were already created in other parts of the world, like Japan, for example. So,
are you familiar with the hacker Gary McKinnon?
Yes, I've heard of him, yes.
Well, Gary McKinnon, when he was hacking some of the defense sites over here, stated that he found a listing of the names of officers that were connected with a space fleet that was in orbit around the Earth. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
I have no doubt that it's true. I think one of the programs that he may have sort of touched on peripherally was later referred to as Solar Warden. The first company that I know of that actually achieved some kind of success with an anti-gravity type propulsion system was Lockheed, back before it became Lockheed Martin, where it combined with Martin Marietta in the mid to late 1980s, from what I remember. But the kinds of propulsion systems that were developed by Lockheed Skunk Works, for example, may have been based on materials that were recovered from the crash or disabling of vehicles that were from off this planet, from somewhere else, some other solar system. In fact, one of the first anti-gravity propulsion systems that were developed was referred to as the Alien Reproduction Vehicle. I've talked to a number of people who've actually seen these things. I've even talked to relatives of people who've worked on them. And when these propulsion systems actually started to go into development, I think probably the first proposal that they came up with in terms of, you know, going beyond just an experimental test bed, but going into a weaponized platform, was probably the vehicle that eventually became part of the Solar Warden program. Now, this may surprise you, but one of those vehicles looked very much like a big flying V, which, of course, is the kind of thing that was being described by some of the witnesses in the Hudson Valley, New York UFO sightings of the late 60s, early 1970s, mm-hmm. Later on into the 1980s. These large V-shaped vehicles, all black, some having lights on them, moving silently, hovering, being able to zip away at unbelievably high velocities, you know, almost as though they've been shot out of a gun. Mm-hmm. No noise, no sonic boom, nothing. Those are all the classic signs of a mass-modified propulsion system, or a system that modifies mass in such a way that accelerations of that kind are not going to destroy the vehicle or the pilot and crew. I have a copy of a photograph from a friend. I'll have to send this to you. It's, of course, copyrighted by the copyright holder, the person who owns this image. But it was taken in 1982 in the northeastern part of California near a community, a little town called Cedarville. It turns out that there is a valley that runs through the extreme northwestern part of Nevada and the extreme northeastern portion of California. It's called the Surprise Valley, of all things. But apparently it's one of the areas where these anti-gravity propulsion systems have been tested for at least a couple of decades. There are all kinds of witnesses out there that have seen them and have photographed them. A lot of people thought that there was an alien underground base or something out there, but it really appears to be an area where there has been a lot of testing of these vehicles. In fact, this, of course, borders the southwestern portion of Idaho, which, if you remember Fox Mulder and the X-Files, that was one of the areas where they were alleging that there was a secret test facility for UFOs and any. Well, that actually is true. When I saw these things on TV, I had to laugh because, most people think that it was just pie in the sky and they were making all this stuff up. But I think Chris Carter, the creator of the show, probably had a lot of inside sources that were feeding him information like that. But these vehicles not only have the ability to move through our atmosphere at a tremendous velocity, make these right angle turns at high speeds, but to go right out into space and to sort of patrol the solar system and maybe prevent intelligences, beings from other worlds and solar systems from coming here, which was kind of the practice suggested by the very name, Solar Warden. So, yes, I think there is a secret space program. When I was part of the Disclosure Project that was put together by Dr. Stephen Greer, I met some of the other witnesses in that program, one of whom was a former, I think he was a Army or Air Force intelligence, working with, I think it was the CIA and Langley, Virginia, and he described a repair job that he was doing on some satellite photographic reconnaissance equipment and the machines that would print out the photography from the digitized signals that they had back there. I guess it was the mid-1960s. Mm-hmm. And he came into a room where there were a group of what appeared to be diplomats from a number of different countries, and they were all gathered around this table looking at photographs, which he did not feel he was cleared, didn't have the classification, the clearance to see these things. But these people all left the room to go on a lunch break, and there was another airman working in the area, and he says, hey, Matt, come on over here, take a look at this. And he said that these were photographs that one of the early satellites that had orbited the moon had taken on the backside of the moon. There were all these bases and radar dishes.
This story. I've heard it.
I talked with the guy directly, and he conveyed in the most poignant sense to me just how terrified, how scared he was when he realized what he was seeing, that there were obviously active facilities of one sort or another on the backside of the moon, and nobody knew who they belonged to. It may be that this secret space force, this secret military presence on the moon, on the backside of the moon, it may have been something that went back decades into the 1950s or something, that was really operating at the behest of sort of the secret government that we always hear about. So, yeah, I do think that there is a classified space program. I'd love to know more about it. I'd love to participate in it, but it's the kind of thing where you just can't talk about it at all. People wouldn't believe it, and of course if they ever had a leak about its real existence and some of the science that's involved in making it all work, I'm sure there'd be a big demand to know exactly how they're accomplishing all those things.
Well, haven't you ever felt that as a an American, you are privy to less information than governments throughout the world? Because the reason I say this is because I think that more is known about what is going on by foreign governments than we, the citizens of the United States, know.
I've had that feeling for a long time, Kent. I absolutely agree with you, and it's a really disturbing feeling to have that that maybe your own government is is keeping from you as a citizen of this country more information than the intelligence services of other countries are prepared to tell their citizens about us and what we're doing. I've suspected for a long time. I mean, when I was asked to do the conceptual artwork for the second generation of that family of aircraft, operating under the umbrella of the name Aurora, when they basically told me, we've got a new aircraft, we need a rendering of this thing, we can't tell you what it looks like, we just want you to draw something that looks really, really fast. I mean, they literally said that to me.
That's terrible.
Tell you what it looks like, but, just use your talent
That's
as an aviation
terrible.
Artist and create something that looks fast. And the really bizarre thing about that was that from my love of history and aviation history in particular, I knew that in the mid 1980s the two fastest aircraft that had ever been built that I was personally aware of
Blackbird
was the SR-71 and the XB-70 Valkyrie, which was a big white aircraft with a kind of a big triangular wing and this huge engine pod with six giant engines in it underneath this wing, two tails, and this big kind of a gooseneck that came up on the front with a couple of smaller wings or canards behind the cockpit. So that was an aircraft, they say, that was capable of nearly Mach 3. It was the kind of plane that would travel so fast that the metal of its skin would turn bright red at altitude.
Right.
Almost like, when the space shuttle comes back through the atmosphere, you can actually see it as it crosses the country. It looks like this bright, glowing, pinkish-red ball of light streaming,
And it would leak fuel while it was on the ground, and as it flew, the metal would expand and seal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was the SR-71, which not only had to be constructed in such a way that it would be able to flex with the amount of expansion of its skin, but also be able to seal up, the fuel tanks and the other parts of the vehicle.
Well, don't you think it's strange that Kelly Johnson, who was the head of the Skunk Works at the time, and probably the greatest aircraft genius that ever lived, that he was able to build a plane using all new technologies that hadn't been invented yet? And he built the SR-71.
Mm-hmm. Well, they accomplished a tremendous amount of advanced uses of not only materials, but the engineering that went into those things. I mean, the aircraft that I worked on in the Air Force, which was the F-106, had one of the most powerful turbojet engines ever built that was put into a single engine aircraft. Mm-hmm. In fact, the 106 pretty much had the record for the fastest single engine aircraft ever built. It had the pinched waist or area ruled fuselage.
Was that the Starfighter?
No, that was another Lockheed production. The Starfighter also had an area ruled fuselage, which pinched into the middle, and it had an earlier generation engine. I think it was actually probably about the same generation in terms of its propulsive capabilities, but no, it was not as fast as the 106.
Wow.
But what I was going to say was that the engine that was used in the F-106 was the same engine that they used two of in the YF-12A, the prototype for the SR-71. Because of the way it was set up, the way that the cone that would come out of the front of the engine would control the airflow going into it as it got faster and faster. So it was kind of designed in the SR-71 as an ultra-high bypass turbojet engine, which means that after you get up to a certain speed, you actually have to reduce the amount of air that's allowed to come into the engine because it gobbles up more air than it can possibly push out the back end. The engine would just burst.
Mm-hmm.
And so you push the cone further and further forward to actually sort of deflect the shockwave, the supersonic shockwave, around the opening so that you're able to control the airflow into the engine, that kind of thing. But for them to be able to do the things that they did, they had to really think outside the box. I know that's a term or a phrase that maybe gets a little overused these days, but it, you know, back in the 1950s when they were conceptualizing this was really wild stuff.
It seems impossible when you examine it.
Well, I know what you're saying. I mean, but they had to find exotic materials that could handle the kind of pressure and the kind of heat. They were using titanium alloys. They were actually putting a corrugated structure in the wing. If you've ever seen the SR-71 up close, you'll notice that the upper and lower surfaces of the wing have these ribs, like the internal structure of a piece of corrugated cardboard. It has that sort of little sort of wavy kind of texture to it on the inside, and they actually incorporated this into the wing surfaces of the SR-71 so that it could expand and contract without splitting the wings apart, you know. But that's the kind of thinking that they employed in this aircraft, and then to make it more, or less radar reflective, the leading edges, the chine that extended off the edge of the wing and went up along the sides of the aircraft like a razor blade sticking out on each side of the fuselage, they had these special ceramic composite panels that were shaped like little pie-shaped wedges, and the wedges would insert along the sides of this the chine and also the leading and trailing edges of the wing. And if you ever see any overhead photography of the SR-71, you'll see these little triangular-shaped panels. And these panels were designed in such a way that when the radar signal from, say, the Russian, surveillance and, you know, early warning system would hit this aircraft, These little pie-shaped wedges of ceramic material would allow the radar energy to come into the body of the aircraft, and it would ricochet back and forth in this tapered panel that was, you know, like a little pie-shaped piece going into the aircraft, and it would start to reflect the radar signal back and forth as the passage narrowed down to the point of this triangle, and it would cancel out the radar signal, so it would reflect almost nothing back to the signal source of the radar. And so in that way, they were able to reduce its RCS, or radar cross-section, the amount of reflected radar energy was coming back up the SR-71. It was really kind of one of the first applications of stealth technology in a weapon system.
What do you think of the fact that the object that crashed in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, in the 60s, looked exactly like the German Bell? According to descriptions of witnesses mm-hmm. that had seen it.
Well, that really lines up chronologically very well with the advent of the alien reproduction vehicle, which also may find some application of that same kind of technology. I mean, if you took away the large capacitor array that's on the bottom of the alien reproduction vehicle, and just were left with the propulsion system and the crew compartment, you'd find something that looked an awful lot like an acorn.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but could you explain to my listeners what the alien reproduction vehicle is?
Yes. The alien reproduction vehicle was, from everything that I've been able to find, was the first application in a piloted vehicle, a human piloted vehicle, of a mass modification type system. The story of the alien reproduction vehicle came from a fellow that I knew in college when I was going to Art Center College of Design in Pasadena. He eventually began working with a number of aerospace contractors, just as I did after he left college. And in about 1980, it was probably August or September of 1988, about 10 years after he and I both left college, I was commissioned to do a cover illustration and some stories for Popular Science magazine. It was the November 1980 edition of the magazine, and the cover story was their first discussion about this plane that everybody was hearing the supersonic shockwave of over Southern California when it was passing between a site out in the Nevada desert, which later became known as Area 51, and an offshore flight test area southwest of the Los Angeles area. and all the seismographic equipment that they had for detecting earthquakes and things along the San Andreas Fault were picking up shocks from the supersonic shockwave hitting the ground, coming down from the aircraft at its extreme altitude. You'd hear these boom, you know, sonic booms from those planes, you know, traveling fast than the speed of sound. And the seismographic equipment was picking this stuff up. And when they started charting the time to distance between this sensor and the next one, they found that these aircraft were going Mach 5. And nobody had ever heard anything about a plane that could do Mach 5. Mm. And so that's how they figured out how fast these things were going, and that, you know, we obviously had something that was probably twice the speed or the capability of the SR-71, and yet it was not being discussed by the military and the public affairs people for the military and the defense contractors. So, you know, when this fellow that I had known in college, Brad Sorensen, and I got together, he saw this story on the cover of the magazine, and he gave me a call, got in touch with the art director, gave him my phone number. We got back in touch, had lunch together, had some discussions, and there was an air show that was coming up at an Air Force base east of Los Angeles out in the community of San Bernardino at Norton Air Force Base, which was one of the big archives for gun camera footage from about the Second World War on. But they had a lot of defense contractors on the base there. And, you know, every year or so they would have an open house at the air base, and the public would be allowed to come in, and they'd have planes on display. And in this particular instance, the air show that was supposed to occur on November 12, 1988, was going to include the SR-71 Blackbird. So I had lunch with Brad, this fellow that I'd known in college, and I invited him to go to the air show, and he indicated to me that he might bring along one or two of his clients so that we might network some jobs together working for various defense contractors. Brad became more of a designer and engineer, and I became more of an illustrator, with my specialty being in aircraft. So at the last minute, the magazine, Popular Science, asked me to do another cover story for them, which was the X-31, which appeared in February of 89. But I had to cancel and not go to the air show. Well, when I talked to Brad about a week later, his entire demeanor sounded and seemed different. He indicated that he thought he had seen some things that he was not supposed to see, and among them was this the so-called alien reproduction vehicle. Now, it took years to finally get the whole story out of him, but the story in its final iteration, its final version, is that during the course of the air show at Norton Air Force Base, Brad and the individual that he had brought along with him to meet with me he was discussing something about the air show, and the Thunderbirds were about to start up their show, and the gentleman he was with said, let's take a walk down here to this big hangar at the west end of the field. And he and a number of other people got on a military passenger jet and were flown up to Air Force Plant 42 in Palmdale, where Lockheed Skunk Works is located. They got off the plane and were escorted into the large hangar at Skunk Works. And as soon as they got in the door, the fellow that Brad was with said, you know, there's some things here in this hangar that I was not aware they were going to put on display. And this is literally just weeks before the first grainy photograph of the F-117A stealth fighter was revealed, and the first rather poor quality conceptual artwork of the B-2 stealth bomber flying wing was unveiled to the media. And the fellow that Brad was with thought that this was going to be kind of the first face-to-face presentation of this aircraft, the stealth fighter, which was manufactured by Lockheed Skunk Works. He thought that that was what was going to be on display, but instead they had not only a number of advanced hovercraft, but they had the losing competitor in the B-2 stealth bomber fly-off competition, which looked an awful lot like a big stealth fighter. It had, you know, all of the little flat panels, the facets, you know, kind of like a cut stone gem or something. But it was more of a flying wing configuration. But they also had the first generation Aurora aircraft in there. That's how I came to know about what it looked like, the flattened out football shape that I described earlier, and its propulsion system. But in a separate section of that same hangar, behind a big black curtain that hung down from the ceiling, you know, when they finally got around to, you know, sort of the final touch, the coup de grace of the presentation, they pulled back the curtains, and here are these three flying saucers sitting there in the hangar, hovering above the floor, with no landing gear underneath, no cables supporting them from above, just hovering there silently in the hangar. And he said that there were three of them. There were there was one that was about 24 feet in diameter, one that was about 60 feet in diameter, and the largest was somewhere between 125 and 130 feet in diameter. And they all had the same general shape and proportions, flat on the bottom, with the lowest section of the aircraft sort of sloping inward, like, let's say you took a cone, a cone-shaped object, and you sliced off, say, the bottom portion of it, and then you took that same portion and you put it, pretty much made the fuselage of this vehicle out of it. It's what's called a frustum, a slice out of a cone, and that's pretty much what the bottom portion of this vehicle looked like. And then there's a little ledge at the top of that frustum-shaped section. And above that was a sphere, the upper part of what was a sphere-shaped crew compartment. You could only see the top half of it. And then, it was kind of humorous, but the hatch to get into this dome, this crew compartment, looked like something out of an old submarine or battleship. It was a steel door with one of those circular wheels on it that you turn, and it had all these little rods or pistons that would push outward into these holes in the framework around the door that would lock it into place, like something on Captain Nemo's submarine or something. It just completely looked like it's out of place. But then around the perimeter of this crew compartment were a number of these plastic bubbles, and under each one was a camera system. And this was referred to as a synthetic vision system. Apparently, these cameras could be slewed or turned and so forth in pairs, which would match up with a camera system that the pilot would wear in his helmet that would give him a left and right view for each of his eyes. And the images that would be projected inside the helmet would allow him to see a complete 3D image of what was outside the vehicle. And probably the reason for that is that, according to Brad and to other witnesses I've spoken to, this vehicle used millions and millions of volts of electrical charge, so much so that the air around the vehicle would become so highly ionized that when the air would begin to glow, it would actually produce what are called X-ray photons, which are absolutely lethal. And in fact, one of the things that Brad said about this vehicle was that it was covered with what he called a goopy lead metallic paint. It looked like a kind of resin that had been painted on, actually rather sloppily, that had, you know, microscopically fine particles of lead that were sort of mixed in, suspended in this resin, and that coating was all over the exterior and all over the interior of this vehicle, and it was intended to protect the pilots from the X-ray photons that were produced by the propulsion system when it interacted with the air outside the vehicle.
Well, do you think this could have been some sort of mock-up? I'll tell you why I ask you that question.
Okay.
Because the China Air Show of 2008 and the Moscow Air Show of 2009, they contained sources also.
Really?
Yeah.
I was not aware of that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I that's all I know about it. I don't know what they looked like or anything,
yeah.
But I know they contained them. And I was wondering if this could have been a mock-up illustrating what they would like to build and maybe showcase some of their equipment, like that helmet, for example, with a heads-up display, which we now know is common, you know?
Well, now, by mock-up, do you mean a prototype, something that had not yet gone into production?
I mean something that could never fly.
Oh. No, these were actually hovering. They were actually actively flying.
Yeah.
At the
time. No, I understand they're hovering, but couldn't that be like a maglev effect?
Well, I'm sure that that's possible. I mean, you can take a powerful electromagnetic field coil and suspend, you know, pieces of aluminum above it in the air. So yeah, that's possible. But the reason, and I was quite skeptical. I mean, my thinking was pretty much in harmony with what you're suggesting. When
it just seems that it would be so top secret.
Oh yeah,
you know,
yeah, it literally was. I mean, you know, but you know, I think you make a great point, Ken, because you know when I first heard the story, I flying saucers at Lockheed Martin, great. But the thing was that as time went by, and as I shared this story with other people that I encountered, in the most unlikely of places, I mean, walking into a one-hour photo shop and having a drawing that I made of this propulsion system based on all of the things that that Brad described for me, something you can see on my website if you want to go up there, www.markmccandlish.com. You just look under unusual aircraft. You know, you click on that. There's a drop-down menu. I think it has alien reproduction vehicle, and there's a black and white line drawing. It's not a very good resolution of it, but it'll give you some ideas of what this thing looked like. And this is kind of a line drawing, a cutaway illustration that I did back in early 1989, based on all the information that I'd gotten from Brad Sorensen at the time. But this vehicle not only was in deployment and being used at the time, but the Air Force had a code name for them. The smallest of the three ARVs was called Baby Bear. The middle one was called Mama Bear, and the largest one was called Papa Bear. And they were nicknamed the Flux Liner, not just alien reproduction vehicle, which of course has all kinds of other connotations. Several years later, in 1992, I was at an air show up at Edwards Air Force Base, and I met a fellow there during the course of the air show who had a rather uninteresting display of black boxes that were part of an advanced over-the-horizon surveillance system that was being used by the Air Force and the Air Intelligence Agency, AIA. This gentleman and I got into a discussion about the Gulf War, the Persian Gulf War, that had just sort of come to a conclusion at that point in time. And I had had a number of contacts in the military, people that I knew who had family members over there who had seen UFOs and things in the theater of operation over the Persian Gulf. Marines that were on ships who said you could see these little white balls of light that would zip across the sky, make right angle turns at high velocities, or stop on a dime. He said they were seeing these things all the time. And so when I mentioned this to the fellow at the display at this air show at Edwards Air Force Base, he grinned and nodded, you know, in a knowing kind of way, like he knew exactly what I was talking about. And then I related to him a rumor that had come to me from a friend of mine, a young lady who engaged in a game of billiards with a young woman who was working at Edwards Air Force Base and who had a husband who was working over a Christmas holiday at an even more secret section of Edwards Air Force Base called Edwards North Base, where they keep all of the classified aircraft that they're test flying at night. And this young woman related how her husband had snuck her into North Base when he was the only one on duty for security one Christmas Eve, and had shown her not only a number of these advanced jet aircraft, but a flying saucer they had in one of the hangars. And so this fellow at the air show at Edwards in 1992 said, oh, yeah, he nodded and as though he knew what I was talking about. And I said, really? You saw this thing? And he says, yes, in 1973 when I was in the Air Force. I said, well, that's funny. I was in the Air Force, too, in 73. I was up at McCord Air Force Base working on 106s in Washington State near Tacoma. And he was at Edwards Air Force Base. He was the crew chief on a plane that was flown by another friend of mine who worked at Aviation Week and Space Technology, an editor by the name of Bill Scott, who's a friend of mine. So we suddenly described, we discovered all this common ground. And I said, well, so how was it that you happened to see this flying saucer or know about this saucer at Edwards North Base, the classified section of the base? And he said, well, he said that they had been working on a an aircraft that had been part of the flight test program. It was middle of the night. His shift supervisor came to him. He's a 20-year-old kid, this fellow I'm talking to. And he says, shift supervisor said that there was a ground power unit, a mule, that was over at North Base that had failed, and they needed to bring it back to the maintenance depot. And he could take a tow vehicle and go over there, pick it up, bring it back. And they'd finished all the other work for the shift. And he says, as soon as you bring that hydraulic power unit back to the depot here, he says, you can go home for the evening. So, like any young kid who wants to go home early from work, if he can do it even earlier, instead of taking Perimeter Road on Edwards Air Force Base, it goes all the way around the dry lake bed where the space shuttle lands on occasion. He just cut straight across the dry lake bed, thinking that he was going to save himself about 45 minutes of time driving around this 10.5 mile loop that would take him over to Edwards North Base. And, of course, the security personnel that were over at North Base were waiting for him at the gate. They did not expect him to come trundling across the dry lake bed and up on the tarmac.
Right.
And so he rolls up onto the runway over there by the hangars at North Base, and there's nobody there. He figured that security was so tight they'd see him coming long before he got there. But he didn't bother radioing ahead or calling anybody on the phone. He just, headed over there. There was no fence between the dry lake bed and the tarmac at North Base, and so he rolled up onto the runway and was proceeding down past one hangar and past the next one, all these sort of the round top, like if you took a cylinder, cut it lengthwise, and laid it on the ground. That's what these hangars look like. They're called a Quonset hut style hangar.
I was in the military.
Oh yeah, well of course, then you know. But so he was rolling past all these Quonset style hangars, and he didn't see any equipment laying around out in the open. But he did see a hangar with the lights on and the door, the big bypass doors in front of the hangar open. So he figured, well, that's got to be where it's at. So he rolls down and he stops in front of this opening where the lights are on. He looks in and here's this flying saucer. And he goes, oh, my God, and it's hovering off the floor. And I said, well, okay, what did it look like? He says, well, it was flat on the bottom. He said it had the sloping sides like you took a section out of a cone, and then there was a dome on the top with all these little glass bubbles and cameras on. And I said, oh, my God.
And that was
this
it.
Is the second verification that I heard of Brad Sorensen's story. And I said, okay, well, I said, let me borrow your pen. So I pulled out the little Kodak lens paper, from my camera, the little envelope that the lens cleaning tissues came in, and I drew a quick little sketch of the ARV according to what Brad had described, flat on the bottom, sloping sides, a dome on the top. And I showed it to this guy. I said, did it look like anything like this? And he says, oh, you've seen one. And I said, no, I never have, but somebody told me about this thing before, and I didn't believe him. And so here there's another fellow telling me about the very thing that he had actually seen. And, of course, he was arrested, and they spent a lot of time debriefing him about, what he was not supposed to have seen and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
but this fellow, the fellow who had been in the Air Force back in 73, who had seen this thing, was during the debriefing, they told him more things about the system than he was actually able to discern just by looking, through this gap in the hangar doors with the lights on.
Right.
And so he gave me additional details about this propulsion system that Brad didn't know about. And so I began to incorporate all these things into this cutaway drawing that eventually became the one that you can find on my website. And, every chance I got when I talked to somebody who I thought, had some kind of inside information about stuff going on behind the scenes in the Air Force, and Bill Scott was one of them, I would say, well, do you know anybody who's heard anything about this, seen anything about this? I was living in Upland, California at the time, and I went into a one-hour Photoshop right around the corner, and I had a picture of this thing that I'd drawn. This ARV, the flux liner alien reproduction vehicle. And this kid said, where did you get that? And I said, I've talked to a couple people who say they've seen this thing. And he says, my uncle's seen that thing. And I said, you're kidding.
Really?
I said, how? Where? And he says, well, you go up through the pass in Interstate 15, leaves the San Bernardino area, and it heads up towards Las Vegas and goes up to Las Vegas, Provo, Utah, Salt Lake City, and stuff like that. And he says, well, there's a A community it's sort of halfway between Barstow and Victorville, California, which is due east of the Edwards Air Force Base complex. And there's a bunch of hills and things up there. In fact, it's the same area where they believe a stealth fighter crashed in the mid-1980s. It was all hushed up. But his uncle was a cattle rancher. And he would take his cattle out, and they'd graze in these hills, and they'd be up there overnight. And then in the morning, he'd go up there with his truck, and he'd kind of put them, you know, get them back together with a little Australian shepherd or something, herding them together and move them to a different area for grazing. But he said he was up there at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning one summer, just as the sun was coming up over the horizon, and this vehicle, just like the one in my drawing, came bopping along through the hills and hovered there for a while and took off. But this gentleman saw it and described it in some detail to his nephew, who in turn said, you know, I mean, and it was stories just like that that came to me over and over again over the years since 1988 that have just continued to flesh out this story and give me more and more detail.
I've always had the feeling that 95% of all the crashes were our stuff, you know?
Well, you know, I mean,
in the beginning, I'm sorry.
Yeah. With the possible exception of the Roswell crash.
Well, I was going to say, in the beginning, there were probably some alien crashes due to the high-powered radar. That's what the theory is anyway.
Yeah.
But after that, I would say that most of the crashes were our stuff, and that's why they were so busy cording it off and taking it away before anybody could see it, because it was all experimental aircraft. At least that's my feeling, you know.
Well, on this particular point, Ken, I would probably have to disagree with you because, you know, if you look back at the level of electronics, I mean, we were just barely scratching the surface of the use of radar at the end of World War II. Electronics, was relying heavily on vacuum tubes and things of that nature. The transistor was unheard of at that point in time. You know, you're probably familiar with the story of Philip Corso, Colonel Richard.
Yes, I am, but trouble with that story is that a lot of people don't believe it. You know, he didn't have very much proof of anything.
Well, you know, I mean, you know? Of course, you know, when you make really exotic statements like the ones that he made, of course, it requires extraordinary proof. You know the old saying, if you look at what was going on back then, and surprisingly, the early attempts at experimentation with radar, which is radio ranging and reconnaissance. The idea is that you send out a signal of a particular frequency, and it's in a burst that goes out from your antenna, and anything that's in the air, even things that are on the ground. The stuff that they often refer to as clutter when they're looking at the radar screen, but the signal, in theory anyway, bounces off a metallic object and is reflected. A portion of it is reflected back like sunlight glinting off of the sheet metal of an aircraft at altitude. We've all seen that. But some of that signal comes back and can be received by the antenna that's incorporated in the system. And because, you know, these things travel, the signal travels at the speed of light, you can, if you know what the speed of light is, you can gauge how far away the object is by the fraction of a second it takes for your signal to go out and be reflected and come back. So you can say, okay, well, it took, you know, so many fractions of a second for the signal to go out and back, and that tells you that it's exactly 12 miles away, or what have you. But the early radar systems that they produced, they had a lot of difficulty narrowing down the frequency that it would transmit at. And so because the transmission was a rather dirty transmission, it spanned a number of different frequencies all at the same time, which, surprisingly, is something that they're now trying to incorporate back into radar in what they're calling ultra-wideband radar, or UWB. Mm-hmm. Ultra-wideband radar broadcasts on a number of different frequencies, and by being able to sort of categorize each of the reflected signals that come back from all the different frequencies, they can actually pick up stealth aircraft as well. something that's kind of like you can see all the energy in the environment and the areas where there's no energy in the environment. And if you have one area in that environment that has an unusual energy return, even if it's not something that you can really focus in and crisply see, you can tell that there is a stealth aircraft there by the fact that there is a lack of a signature in this mm-hmm. one spot of the sky.
Well,
it's kind of like a negative image, you know. It's like mm-hmm. the reversal.
Instead well, let me tell you what Timothy Good told me.
Well, let me just finish.
Oh,
that
I'm
point.
Sorry.
The,
Go ahead.
The thing about ultra-wideband radar is that the theory was that when they were experimenting near Four Corners in the United States, where I guess it's Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah come together, it's right near the Painted Desert, and that's where their test site was for these these early rudimentary radar systems that were very much like ultra-wideband. And what their theory was is because of the crashes that occurred at I think it was there's one near Flagstaff, Paradise, Arizona, Aztec, New Mexico, Roswell, New Mexico, and there was even one down there, Socorro, New Mexico, uh-huh. or Mexico, I believe it was. But if you look at where each of those crashes occur, it's all within the same general region of where these radars were being tested at the time. And the theory, as you're describing, was one in which this rudimentary radar, because it blanketed a number of frequencies with this sort of dirty transmission, it was scrambling the not just the propulsion system, but the guidance systems for the craft, mm-hmm. and they were crashing as a result. And that's when we began to actually have a number of successful retrievals.
Right.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, right. So that's okay. No problem. Well, Timothy Good had told me in an interview that. And I think it was Timothy Good, I'm almost sure, that the Russians had discovered that the radar was interfering with UFOs and bringing them down. Mm-hmm. So in the early 1960s, they built a radar weapon. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, I'm. I think it was called a Maser, if I'm not trying to. That may not be the right word.
Well, anyway, we'll call it
microwave application. Yeah. Yes, okay, that might be it.
We'll just call it a super-powered radar station for now. And yes. He said that a UFO came down, shot a beam through one of the guards without hurting him. The beam passed through his body, hit the radar station, and blew it to pieces.
Wow. Well, either that soldier would have had to have been way up in the sky, or this thing must have been sitting on the ground when it fired the beam. But, you know, I've heard stories like this. I've interviewed. In fact, you know, when I really kind of decided that, yes, there were flying saucers, and yes, this story must be true. I mean, if I've got friends in the defense industry that are seeing things in hangars that certainly suggest we've got this technology, then, you know, the story about Roswell and, even the so-called alien abduction phenomena must have some basis in reality. So, I mean, I began actively looking for people to interview myself who mm-hmm. claimed that they'd been taken up in the sky by aliens, because my hope always was that even if these people had no technical expertise at all, if they saw any propulsion system components, they would be able to describe what they saw, not even knowing what they were. I mean, you know, if you see a big coil of copper wire, you know that you've got some kind of a high voltage system involved. If you see, if you've ever had an X-ray, I mean, then you've probably seen what the apparatus of an X-ray machine looks like, with these cylinders that sort of impinge upon one another, right angles, and all these different things. And, you know, even though you may not know how an X-ray machine works, if you're familiar with what an X-ray machine looks like, if someone says, "Well, yeah, there's all these cylinders, they're sort of, intersecting one another in the body of this device," then you'd have to say, "Well, you know, that sounds an awful lot like an X-ray machine." And so that is what I did, and I talked to some of these people, and I mean, many of them had artifacts in their body that you could see beneath the skin or behind mm-hmm. their eardrums and things of this nature, and they described components that looked and sounded exactly like the same components that Brad Sorensen had described in the alien reproduction vehicle. And so here I was getting confirmation of componentry inside these vehicles from people who had nothing to do with the military at all, and from systems that were obviously incorporated in vehicles that were not ours. There were a lot of bizarre events. I mean, certainly we can talk about it sometime, some of the experiences I had dealing with the abductees and mm-hmm. some of the really strange stuff that happened in association with them and being around them or talking to them, spending the night with them when there was supposed to be an abduction going on. And
I might make for a good second interview.
Oh yeah, it's really, really crazy stuff. I'm sure you'd love it. But this was kind of how I started, sort of confirming for myself that there was something to all of this. And just as I was telling you before, I began to recognize that many of these components had a striking resemblance to things like a giant Tesla coil or a Van de Graaff generator and things of this mm-hmm. nature, things that are responsible for creating extremely high voltage discharges. And, as time went on, if you had a lot of money to blow, and you said, okay, Mark, let's build a flying saucer, I really believe I could build one and that it would work. Just based on what I've been able to find over the last 20 years or so, because I've talked to a lot of the top physicists around the country, I've picked their brains, and I've said, well, no, if you had these kind of components and they were doing this, and this, what would you have? And many of them registered a tremendous amount of surprise when I described what I was, talking about and what the components were supposed to do and what their orientation relative to one another was going to be and what I expected to see in the way of, some kind of effects as a result of those, different components coming together in a particular way.
Last question, Mark. So would you agree that what we're really talking about is both man-made and alien-made craft that are in the skies?
Yeah, I would say that you were probably talking about the complete spectrum of everything in between, the completely human-made devices. Probably based on things that we've learned, in the 60 years or so since Roswell, and all the way over to things that are completely off-world, that have never been touched by human hand. And then systems that are in between, that are hybrids or combinations of the two technologies. And in fact, the photograph I was describing earlier, it was taken near Cedarville, California, that I think is what eventually became known as the Solar Warden vehicle, the big flying V that we described. There is one of these things in the distance in this Polaroid photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like a combination of a stealth fighter. It has all the faceted shapes and, contours, but it also has three of these large silver spheres embedded in the fuselage, one right up at the apex of the V, and then one midway down the length of each of this, wing-like appendages. And it's a very spooky-looking vehicle. So, I think we probably have everything from, systems that we've developed entirely on our own, and probably developed as a result of things that we've been able to back engineer from recovered crashes, all the way up to stuff that's completely alien. So, yeah, I think that's where we're at.
Mark, I want to thank you for a very, very interesting interview.
I enjoyed it, Ken. Let's do it again sometime.
We will.